Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, Neil, we are having a sweet talk with Olivia Colman and Timothée Chalamet about Wonka, and we're rating that as well as Your Christmas or Mine number two, and Leave the World Behind. Plus, we are chatting to Julianne Moore, Natalie Portman and Charles Melton about their awards hopeful May-December. But before we get on to those, what else have you been watching this week, or where have you been in the world?
Well, I've just got back from my second visit to the Marrakesh International Film Festival. It was the second edition this year, and the organisers really pulled out the stops, kind of star-wise. I was there for 5 days, and there were screen talks by Mads Mikkelsen, Willem Dafoe, Tilda Swinton and Matt Dillon. Jessica Chastain chaired the very starry festival jury that included Joel Edgerton, Camille Cotin and Alexander Skarsgård, very tall. And there was even an appearance expected from Martin Scorsese, but unfortunately that got cancelled at the last minute. One thing about Marrakesh is they just love it when the stars come to visit. And so every time with one of these Q&A things, when they stand up to ask a question, it's always preceded by this very long and fulsome thank you for coming to visit us and a heartfelt statement of how much that person's films have meant to them. So it must be great for the stars to hear. Though not everything this year was quite so respectful. At Matt Dillon's screen talk, which happened to take place in this very large, echoey hall, a cat snuck in and proceeded to interrupt him with these rather loud, reverberating meows. Matt took it all in his stride, of course. He is, after all, cool for cats. It did kind of get me thinking a bit of Steve Martin as Dr. Hufferfer in The Man with Two Brains. And that scene where he's performing brain surgery in an operating room filled with cats saying,
yes,
get that cat out of here.
Yeah. What happened to the cat? Was it removed by security?
They're very wily in Marrakesh. You know, you try and catch them and they see you coming. So it's best just to leave them and let them go of their own accord, which is kind of what happened.
Well, he must have been a very big film fan, you know? Maybe he was just like desperate to tell Matt about, you know, how much he loved his work.
I hope that Matt was feline happy as a result of that love. On the film front, I particularly liked a new film starring Isabel Huppert. Last year at this same event, I saw her in a film called La Syndicaliste, which I didn't really think much of, but I thought she was much better suited to this film called Sidonie in Japan, which is a kind of later life romance between her character, a widowed novelist doing a book tour in Japan, and the diffident, rather taciturn local publisher who's escorting her from city to city. I quite liked that, and I quite liked another film, which I think we'll be hearing more of in the awards conversation, called Bye Bye Tiberius, which is a documentary about the French-Palestinian actress Ayam Abbas and her family's experiences of kind of exile and displacement over the decades. That was basically my second trip to the International Marrakesh Film Festival.
Very nice indeed. Shall we go on a trip now to somewhere else then and load up on sugar? It's this.
I've spent the past 7 years traveling the world perfecting my craft. You see, I'm something of a magician, inventor, and chocolate maker. So quiet up and listen down. Nope, scratch that, reverse it.
Mr. Wonka, I can see you're a man of great ingenuity.
What are you doing?
I'm making chocolate, of course. How do you like it? Dark, white, nutty, absolutely insane.
Many people have come here to sell chocolate. They've all been crushed by the chocolate cartel. You can't get a shop without selling chocolate. And you can't sell chocolate without a shop.
No daydreaming.
What are we gonna do, Willy?
Huh?
A double huh?
Do you have a pencil and paper?
Uh-huh.
I got an idea.
So this is Wonka, the origin story of Roald Dahl's Confectioner, starring Timothée Chalamet as the fledgling chocolatier. Before we talk about this and whether it's, you know, an absolute gobstopper delight or not so much, let's listen to what Olivia Colman, playing Wonka's washerwoman nemesis, and Timothée Chalamet as the chocolatier had to say about eating chocolate, dancing and Dune 2 when I sat down with them last week.
Mark my words! Going to be the greatest chocolate shop the world has ever seen.
Thank you so much for joining Total Films podcast. We did a cover feature when it was the actor strike, so we couldn't talk to you guys, but we did talk to your on-set chocolatier, which amazing. So big questions first. How much did you manage to eat? And is it on your sort of rider going forward that you have an on-set chocolatier?
At all times.
How much did you eat?
Not that much, because in my set there wasn't any.
You drank all that poison at the end.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, too much. My favorite was In a World of Your Own. You know, I take a bite out of a chocolate teacup at the end, which was sort of straight out of the original. And that's an idea that Paul had 12 hours before we shot that scene.
She made it last minute.
Boom, boom, boom.
Wow. Because I thought it would be some hero chocolates.
Yeah.
But apparently she made everything.
No, she made everything, yeah. Yeah.
So when you get the call from Paul about this film, what's the sort of reaction? Is there trepidation about it? Like, do you have sort of worries about taking on such a beloved sort of thing? Or was it that you just wanted to get stuck in? What did you think, Timothy? I mean, obviously...
Trepidation because the character's so beloved, so people are very protective over characters and films they love, so it's almost blasphemous from the get to go near it. But then, because it was Paul King, just very excited, and I loved Paddington 2 and Paddington, and felt like I was stepping into this Sunday roast of British all-stars, you know? So, yeah.
But also, you are as just beautiful as Wonka. Totally the right choice.
Thank you.
Couldn't have picked a lovelier person. And for me, there wasn't a previous Mrs. Scrubbit, so much easier. I think she's going to have a spin-off now, though.
When I talked to Paul about the singing, he said that you sounded like Bing Crosby.
The music supervisor in this name, James Taylor, so I did lessons with him, and then a lovely gentleman named Eric Vitro in L.A., and these are the men that take woeful actors, and I think I get the best advice. Singing is acting on pitch.
You must have been fairly good to start with, though.
I did some in musical theatre, a little bit in high school, yeah.
And Saturday Night Live, of course. We've seen you singing to a tiny horse before this.
Yes, yes. I just got that tiny horse. I got the actual one.
So tell me about the song and dance numbers. This is like, if you're an actor, this is a sort of thing that you sort of dream about, and we don't really see many of films like this, so... Was it fun? Is it fun to twirl around and do the singing and dancing and big sort of set pieces and beautiful sets?
Not me. I didn't
do any of that. There's the end of Scrub Scrub.
Yeah, I go scrub scrub. Yeah. Which isn't really singing or dancing.
No.
But amazing to watch everybody else do it. It's, I don't know about you, but you do, well, at drama school, there's dancing and never ever have I used it. Well, I did one film with dancing, but mainly the difficult bits were a proper dancer. With my face.
Did they CGI you?
Yeah.
No,
you were brilliant at it.
I loved it. I loved it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's unlike, you know, being like a, doing a serious drama and mining yourself. Or this is more like, I don't know, more expressive.
Was that a conscious decision then to sort of step away from that sort of role that you've been doing a lot of? I mean, before this, you were a cannibal. So did you really want to find something like this?
No, I feel like I just want to work with great directors. And, you know, Luca Guadagnino gave me, who did Bones and All, the cannibal movie, and Call Me By Your Name, who I wouldn't have a career without. Paul King is his favorite director. And Tilda Swinton. These are two. I would, like, respect them enormously. So when I got this, it was like, it felt like a no-brainer.
Tell me about the sets, because obviously they're amazing, and they're all in Britain. You filmed this all in the UK. They're all real and physical. Was that a treat to sort of play in that space as well?
The only set I was in was the laundrette. But every drawer you opened had the printed scrub it and bleacher paper, and it was amazing. And the till worked, and everything has been thought of. So you feel like, God, my job's so easy. Mm-hmm. I come in and they've made me look better. We did go and visit your factory, the chocolate shop.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was my favourite set.
We might have broken it.
Really, actually?
Tom went on the... Tom Davis. Not a small chap.
Yeah, he walked on the pad.
Yeah.
Really?
And he went... Gook.
That's and what I that went, sign
he did
was.
It! And ran away. Yeah. Was the sign saying...
There was a sign. I found out why right now. There was a spot on the set that it was like there's a hole...
That was Tom Davis. Tom Davis did that.
Scoop.
Scoop.
Yeah. What was it like when you saw those sets?
Awe-inspiring. And because of the tone, too, because it wasn't like some heavy film, it had that old school building, the fantastical old Hollywood quality.
Speaking of physical things, my little boy watched this and wants to know, did you choose your teeth and why? And is your chocolate cabinet real? How practical is that?
I had two sets of teeth. I had the... yellowing ones, and then I had the brightly coloured ones once I'd eaten the poison. So I was very excited. We did go through different shades of teeth, and there was one that was really grubby, but we thought maybe that was too much, so we went for the pale.
Really?
Yellow.
And then pull back?
Yeah. I never do too much, you know, I'm very subtle.
I loved that chocolate box was almost entirely practical, and it was the throes of COVID, so the one thing that felt like was missing was like a little hand sanitization station. So they added a little
that
thing.
That was brilliant.
So the box opens and cleans his hands, make sure they're not dirty.
Can't go without asking you both about your next projects, which are so exciting to us. Paddington 3 and Dune 2.
Yeah, and Wicked Little Letters.
Wicked Little Letters.
Oh my God, it's amazing. I'm so pleased you asked.
Did you already shoot it?
Yes, we've already shot it. And it's a true story. In the 20s, these poison pen letters started arriving and this sort of pious Christian woman's house. And everyone thought it was the neighbour who was a bit of a potty mouth. And I don't want to ruin it for you, but it was literally debated in Parliament and it was on the front of all the broadsheets.
Wow.
These letters that say, you stinky ass bitch. And things
but would like kill that. Would kill people or no? You're saying poison letters, like actual...
Sort of as in vicious, nasty letters. No, that would have been much cooler.
An ignorant American.
No,
I thought you meant like with anthrax or something.
It's too late to recut it.
But what about Paddington?
I'm so excited. And I met Paddington. I absolutely loved it. I got there quite late, so they'd already done most of it. I was like a kid in a sweet shop. It was just so exciting. And again, I'm not necessarily a good person in it.
And riding a sandworm.
Yeah, riding a sandworm. Yep.
Is it real?
Yeah. Well, it's Christian Bale who put on 400,000 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
He is so
He's
method.
Committed.
Yeah.
I stole that joke. If that makes it in there, I stole that. That was an internet. That was a great article that we all sent around on set where somebody put out a thing saying Christian Bale's been cast as the sandworm is going to put on 500,000 pounds. No, but it's great. Yeah, I'm excited.
Okay, so that is Timmy, as they call him, Timmy and Olivia, talking about Wonka and sandworms. Let's get on to this film then. It's been on every single bus. It's on every, you know, if you click on a website, Wonka ads are on there. They're throwing a lot of money at this. Neil, for those of us who haven't been out in the street and haven't seen this, haven't been bombarded with the advertising, what is this about?
Well, it's a prequel, essentially, to the Willy Wonka character that we saw first played by Gene Wilder in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and then later by Johnny Depp in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, directed by Tim Burton. So those two films are very much straight adaptations of the Roald Dahl book, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in which Willy Wonka, this eccentric chocolatier character, first emerged. This goes back earlier into his life, and it basically finds out how he became a chocolatier. He's first discovered arriving at an unnamed sort of Middle European mix of Bavaria and Paris. This
bit Viennery.
It's basically the centre of chocolate. And he's been travelling the world for 7 years, going to different kind of places and weird exotic islands, coming up with all the exotic ingredients and recipes he needs to create these chocolates that are going to blow the world with chocolate apart. And so he's got everything he needs apart from basically a shop and a bit of money in his pocket. But he's got lots of great recipes and, as his opening song says, a hat full of dreams. What he doesn't have is premises. When he tries to get some, he runs up against the chocolate cartel, these three businessmen who are very anti anyone invading onto their patch, and they use their political connections, their power with the police force to effectively have him more or less thrown into jail and almost run out of town. Anything they can do to stop him becoming a chocolatier that's going to rival their businesses.
It's a musical. As soon as we begin, straight out the gate, Timmy is trilling at the top of a boat mast, and those songs keep on coming. Those are written by Neil Hannon of the Divine Comedy. Did they earworm you? Were the songs good? How did you like Timmy being Wonka?
Timmy is very charming as Wonka. He's very winsome. He's very innocent. There's very little darkness of the character, of the Roald Dahl character. You don't really see how he's going to grow up to become anything like the character that Gene Wilder played, and certainly not the character that Johnny Depp played, which were very kind of rather bizarre and vaguely threatening creations. Mm. He is a puckish innocence personified with a decent set of pipes. I don't think singing is necessarily Timothy's forte, but he makes a good kind of fist of these rather jolly numbers that Neil Hammond has put together for us. And the fact that one of them is the classic Poor Imagination is a nice kind of link to what's gone before. What I did find a little strange is that the film was so focused on his chocolate making ventures. It doesn't really seem to give him much of an emotional or internal life. There's a missing mother that he's kind of lost along the way, and it's his kind of desire to make the chocolates that would have made her proud. There is that to give him a bit of emotional heft, if you like. But it doesn't even conscious about that he might have a romantic life or want to kind of pick up a Mrs. Wonka along the way. That doesn't seem to be at all in the cards. The chief relationship he does have is this young orphan called Noodle, played very charmingly by a newcomer called Calla Lane. And they form a kind of team with fellow people who, in a rather kind of strained subplot, have become prisoners of Olivia Colman's character for reasons I couldn't quite work out. They form a kind of sort of their own little cabal to beat the evil cabal. And it becomes quite entertaining how they manage to foil the bad guys and eventually bring Woolly's chocolates to the world. And of course, with the help of one special character who is, anyways, the movie's secret weapon.
Yes, the lovely Oompa Loompa that turns up, fashioned by Hugh Grant. This is, of course, we should have mentioned at the top, this is written and directed by the man behind Paddington, Paul King. So he obviously has this relationship with Hugh Grant. He told us in our cover feature that when he tried to think of the most curmudgeonly person he could to play an angry Oompa Loompa, it was Hugh Grant he thought of. So that's why he's in this. He is fantastic, isn't he? There's not enough Hugh Grant as an Oompa Loompa for my money.
Yeah, there's very little Hugh Grant in the movie. Well, there's very little of little Hugh Grant in the movie, who is, we should say, is a CGI concoction of Hugh Grant's orange head on a sort of little body of a little orange man with green hair, who, for other rather convoluted reasons, has been following Willy Wonka and stealing his chocolates at various points in his story until Willy managed to capture him and find out what's going on and turn him into a sort of reluctant ally. He comes in and around about half the movie, and he instantly gives it a massive jolt of humor and comedy and just sort of weirdness. And it's great. And you really want much more of Hugh Grant than either the script or the budget can allow. I think he's only in about 5 scenes, and 3 of them are in the trailer. So yeah, you kind of have to enjoy every time Hugh Grant comes along, because like you say, there's not really nearly enough of him.
Yeah, it's not quite funny enough for me, and it's not quite heartfelt enough. So it didn't bring a tear to my eye and really truly made me laugh, apart from when Hugh Grant was dancing around with his little flute. It felt like it didn't quite get there for me. I'm a big fan of Paddington. I think they're so exceptionally crafted and beautiful. And this, I felt, was a little below a Paddington movie. It doesn't quite reach those heights. But then I wondered, as you said, we don't really understand the connective tissue between this Wonka and the Wonka he'll become in the factory when he is a trickster. He's somebody who's quite happily sees, you know, Augustus Gloop slurped up a pipe when he could die. He's not at all bothered that a child is turned into a blueberry. He's not fussed about that. And in this film, he signs a contract that is unwittingly full of small print, which is exactly what Wonka does to the children when they go into the office in the Gene Wilder version. So you're like, why would somebody who'd been tricked by this as a young man then use it later? And my only suggestion is that because there's a plan for 1 or 2 more films to fill that gap, to fulfill that journey. So this is purposefully kept quite opaque and not nearing that character because there are plans for a franchise. Call me cynical, but that seems to be why this is the way it is.
Well, one element which, again, I couldn't quite understand, because he's such a personable character and his command of language is wonderful. And yet, for reasons which I think are purely plot motivated, he is discovered to be illiterate.
Yes.
Which is an unusual kind of hurdle for him to have to overcome. And one that I think is purely so that he signs the contract that makes him a sort of de facto slave of the Olivia Colman character. I don't know. That sounds like an odd embellishment. What I will say is the film is beautiful to look at. The
gorgeous
production design by Nathan Crowley is amazing. The costume design by Lindy Hemming is astonishing. And it's just such a feast for the eyes. And it really is a sort of continuation of the Warner Bros. sort of Leavesden spectaculars that they that from the sort of Harry Potter school of opulent production design and kind of 360 world building that's created in those films. Yeah, there's something a little bit missing in the center of it. He managed to open a shop with all these incredible confections, and I'm thinking, when did you get time to do these or the ingredients to make this?
It's, yes, considering you need giraffe milk just for one chocolate, where's he getting all the rest of them? Yeah. See, that's the other thing I couldn't get on board with. Why is he suddenly magical in this? He's able to concoct things out of his hat at any given moment. So if that's the case, why is he then confined by something as pedestrian as a contract? And then he's not magical when we get to him as, you know, Willy Wonka as Gene Wilder. He's just a sort of a genius, a mad genius. So I don't really understand why he's suddenly magical, and the rules of that magic either didn't seem to make sense to me. But again, maybe I'm just being a curmudgeon about this.
I think there are definitely kind of things that seem to be have either kind of brushed over or things that don't make sense if you kind of hold them up to light. I mean, if he's able to create magic, then why does he need a factory? If he's able to, you know, create chocolates out of thin air, why does he need a shop? It seems to be weirdly its own thing, and yet it's trying to squeeze into the existing conception of the character while also giving him attributes he's never had before. The other thing I didn't particularly care for is there's a character played by Keegan-Michael Key, who is a chocoholic police inspector who gets progressively more overweight over the course of the movie, which seemed to me a bit lazy and fattest this day and age. I didn't think that was necessary, really necessary. But what I did like was the supporting cast. The team that Wonka builds around him, played by Jim Carter and Rick Fulcher, and this sort of these people who also have become prisoners of the Olivia Colman character. And yet, rather like the prisoners who help Paddington break out of prison in Paddington 2, become Wonka's allies, and they form this kind of Mission Impossible-like team, able to kind of pull off a big heist at the end of the movie. That's the element I really enjoyed, and I thought that's where the various plot threads kind of came together most successfully.
Yes. My favourite actually was Tom Davis, who plays Bleacher, Mrs. Scrubbit's paramour. And there's a scene where he turns up in some lederhosen leather shorts that is just genius. Again, in short supply, I think I wanted more fun and more humour, and the sweetness of it felt sentimental rather than heartfelt. Yeah, for me, it's a sweetie, you know, it's like, it's not my favourite when you get your quality streets and you pick your favourite out. It's not that one. It's not those Duff ones right at the bottom, the ones that they now put in that are just the pure chocolate that are rubbish. But it's somewhere in between. My favourite is a toffee penny. The full chocolate is my least favourite. I'm in the middle there. Probably the caramel hazelnut one. What is it for you on a sweetie scale?
I think it's one of those kind of orange or strawberry creams where you bite into it and they kind of ooze out of you when you bite into it. It's very sweet, but maybe too sweet. But I think there's plenty of entertainment here, and I think it will be a more than enough hit for there to be more Wonkas, and what we really want, a lofty spin-off starring Hugh Grant.
Yes, yes. We want the origin story of him. Okay, so it's, you know, great fun for all the family. You know, no one's going to be pissed off going to the cinema to see this at Christmas. It's what you want at Christmas. It's all of that stuff. But I still think, you know, not a toffee penny. Wonka is in cinemas on Friday. Right, are you ready to go skiing now? It's this.
I'm sorry, but who on earth would book to stay in a place like this?
Berg, Schaff, Schaffberg. Well, that's almost right.
I have got an incredible sense of deja vu.
And we've got your suitcase here.
We realise.
Oh dear.
I shall take you to Hotel Shaft.
No, no way.
Well, don't walk where it happened.
Whenever I think about the future, I...
Hubie Hugh!
What's happening?
I meet Edmonton, oh my God!
My two favourite people in the world. What are the chances?
Yeah, what are the chances?
I think I know how to get down a ski slope.
She knows how to stop.
I don't think she knows how to stop.
So this is Your Christmas or Mine, number two. There was a one. Did you see it?
Yeah, the first Your Christmas or Mine came about a year or so ago, and that introduced us to these young couple called James and Haley, who are both acting students in London, and they're gearing up to go home for Christmas, and they make the decision to swap trains and surprise each other's homes. And because they've both done it at the same time, one of them ends up with his parents and the other ends up with her family. It was a rather sort of sweet way of upending the whole kind of Christmas movie staple. Had a fair amount of charm, a lot of contrivances, and it introduced this sort of extended cast, which are now back for Your Christmas or Mine Too, in which, as usually happens in sequels, they go abroad. This time, the families are going to go on a joint Christmas trip to the Austrian Alps. And Haley's family, who come from working class Macclesfield, have chosen a sort of more kind of affordable budget hotel. Whereas James's father and his new American girlfriend have chosen this very upscale resort. You can guess what happened. They end up in the opposite hotels, basically. So you've got Haley and her large, raucous brood, which includes Daniel Mays as her father and Angela Griffin as her mother, kind of living it large on this wonderful kind of she resort. And you've got James, his father, Alex Jennings, and his new American girlfriend, played by James Bukowski, sort of roughing it in this crumbling chalet run by this rather grumpy farmer.
It's rustic, isn't it? They've got the rustic one. So this is basically Carry On Abroad, but with a bit more modern technology. And there's still romance in it. There's snow and there's Christmas, but there's also romance, which is what the first film also had. Does it work a second time around? Is it a charm twice?
Well, I think the first film had a certain charm, and it played on the whole kind of people being in different places and fish out of water times two, really. So it worked on that kind of level, and it built to quite a sort of nice Christmas, everyone sat around the same Christmas table finale. This plays the same scenario with skis, eggnog, and a fair amount of hijinks involving being up in the mountains, and both people are on territory they're not very familiar with. It was okay. It kind of passed the time. The best part of it was Jane Krakowski as his father, withering American self-help guru who gets on everyone's nerves with her sort of self-help mantras and her rather sort of withering disdain for everything. And there's a bit of comic confusion about Haley has become convinced that James is going to propose and whether that's going to happen, whereas James is really trying to tell Haley that he's been offered a filmmaking course that's going to take him away for a year. So there's that kind of feeling, is that could this be their last Christmas as well as their latest? I didn't find it terribly gripping. I thought they had some nice scenes. I thought that the best parts of the supporting characters, Daniel Mays and Alex Jennings. But all told, if this was Under the Tree, I'd probably unwrap it last.
So this is on Prime, so you don't have to bother going out to see it. You can just, sit at home and watch it. Is it suitable for that, or would you not even bother?
I think it would serve a perfectly pleasant Christmas watch when you've kind of watched everything else. You've eaten pretty much every last Quality Street in the tin. This would be a good way to round off the evening. But I don't necessarily feel that the characters and their families were so endearing and so lovable and so darn wonderful to be with that we really needed a second helping of this.
You've not sold me. I'm not interested in this one. I think I liked last week's There's Something in the Barn. If I'm going to watch a family with a strident mother figure who's into self-help and is set in the snow and things go comically awry, I think There's Something in the Barn is probably the better option. But if you fancy Your Christmas or Mine Two, it is on Amazon Prime from Friday. Right, shall we go from one family vacation muddle to another? It's this.
I went online this morning and I rented us a beautiful house out by the beach. I figured if I made the reservation and packed our bags, it would eliminate most of the reasons to say no.
Oh, this is nice. Kids look so happy.
The Wi-Fi isn't working.
So sorry to bother you, but this is our house.
This is your house?
We were driving back to the city, then something happened.
You want to stay here, but we're staying here.
We need to get them out of here.
I need to think everything's gonna be okay.
Everything is gonna be okay, isn't it?
We are seeing ongoing cyber attacks across the country.
So this is Leave the World Behind. It's based on a novel, which sort of caused a stir when it came out because of its sort of timeliness in its themes. Just tell us, who is going on holiday and what is happening in this one?
There is a married couple called Amanda and Clay and their two children who make a sudden decision to spend a weekend or a few days out of New York City on Long Island. She sees a nice home to rent, so she picks up the family and they just drive off to where they hope they're going to have a pleasant and carefree vacation. But weird things are happening. The world is somehow out of kilter. They're on the beach and a tanker starts heading randomly into the beach and runs itself aground. There's weird kind of animals. The deer are congregating for no apparent reason, very Hitchcockian on the lawn.
Yes, very like the birds.
Most sort of disconcerting at all. The two people arrive who purport to be the owners of the place they're staying in, played by Mahershala Ali and his daughter, played by Mahalia, who say that they've become stranded on the way back to New York. So they've come and they're asking effectively to stay in their own home. So the scenario is very similar in a way to Knock at the Cabin, the M. Night Shyamalan film from earlier this year. And this idea of having your, what you think is your safe space, not necessarily invaded, but kind of infringed upon by people whose motives you're not entirely sure on. Gradually, more and more things start going disastrously awry, and it becomes clear that the New York and America, maybe the world at large, is the victim of some kind of cyber terrorist attack that's knocking planes out of the sky and stopping the internet from working, and at least as far as their youngest daughter is concerned, stopping her from watching the last episode of Friends.
Yes,
which is giving her a great deal of anxiety. She's desperate to know how the show ends. It's a sort of apocalyptic parable / satire on our kind of self-absorbed way of living and how easily it can be knocked out of kilter by things out of our control.
One of the sort of attractions of this is the cast, right?
Yes, indeed. Julia Roberts, not usually in this sort of unflattering role of this rather brittle, unsuspecting, rather harsh person who doesn't seem to want to trust anybody. I heard of her being called a Karen.
I would say so.
No significance of what a Karen means. She's very much one of those. And her husband in respect is a kind of laid back, just wants to get on with everybody kind of guy. Both those two viewpoints are very much put under the microscope.
And Kevin Bacon
turns up very brief at the beginning and then for a much longer scene in the end as this sort of local survivalist who seems to know a lot more about what's going on than Mahershala Ali's character does, who is the owner of the house who comes to kind of stay with them. It's a character piece and there's some good acting between them. And the scenes particularly between Julia Roberts and Mahershala Ali, I think, are very strong. And I think the young kids are okay as well. His daughter is played by Mahalia, who was in Bodies, Bodies, Bodies and the TV show Industry. And I think she brings a real kind of cutting and sort of sardonic wit to the proceedings. But it's one of these films where so many weird things are happening. There can't really be a logical explanation for it. And you're kind of waiting for it to happen. and you're kind of waiting and you're kind of waiting. And what you get really isn't what you would hope for at the end of this. It's a very M. Night Shyamalan film.
It's very sort of, and it's sort of downbeat, isn't it? There isn't any sort of big reveals. It's more of a sort of slide into world chaos than an explosion. Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's some really great character acting happening here. And I loved watching Julia Roberts be this sort of woman who the nuance she puts into her basic racism is what we're talking about here is incredible. Just in the way she says, this is your house to this couple that turn up in the middle of the night. The constant way that she is threatened by them and scared of them, it sort of reminded me of Us and that sort of tension and that horrible recognizability of it. And as you say, Ethan Hawke is just this guy, you know, we know guys like that who are just like, hey, you know, can't we just all get along? But he's saying that from a position of, you know, white privilege. Of course, it's easy to get along and be a nice guy with everybody if that's your position in life. So it's actually really quite scathing and sharp and nasty, but wrapped up in this heightened world. I mean, even when she starts talking, when Julia starts talking at the very beginning, she says these things while standing at a window that no normal person says. It's very actually, it's stagey, it feels heightened. And I think as soon as you see that, you'll know whether you like this film or not going forward, because that's the tone and register that the whole film is in. And I think it might be kind of annoying for some people. I personally got a kick out of it.
Well, it's written and directed by Sam Esmail, with whom Julia worked on the first and best season of his TV series Homecoming. So clearly, you know, he's won her trust. She'll go with him wherever he wants to take her. And it takes it to some pretty dark places. I did feel it was a long movie. I mean, for...
it's 2 hours 21, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think it needed to be that long. And I don't think it took us to a destination that really justified that level of length. I mean, there's some great moments in it, and there's some really freaking unsettling scenes. There's a scene in which they're trying to drive back to New York, and they find the freeway blocked with self-driving Teslas with more to follow. And this idea that these self-driving cars can kind of like develop minds of their own or become sort of like weapons of some unknown malevolent force is really quite scary. That creates, I think, one of the most effective moments in the film. But it is a very long film, and I don't think there are quite as many effective moments as there should have been.
Yes, perhaps. I would agree with that. But to me, it does play like a love child of Us and Knock at the Cabin. And for my money, I find that quite entertaining. So I was intrigued by it. I didn't necessarily know where it was going. And in this day and age, I quite enjoy that in a film.
Maybe it was conceived as a TV series. I don't know. But maybe they had it more to go with it, or it could have gone more. Maybe there could be more of a future for these characters. Who knows? But yeah, there's plenty of food for thought in Leave the World Behind, I think.
I agree. I think you'd have a good chat after watching this. This is on Netflix. So if you didn't want your prime offering of Your Family's in the Snow, you could pop over onto the other side and watch this from Friday and have a very different family holiday on this one. Right. We reviewed this a few weeks ago when it was in cinemas, but it's now hitting Sky Movies. It's this.
Feels like things just settled down and now y'all are making a movie.
It's a very complex and human story.
I think it's hard to trust that you're going to represent
Gracie as she was.
I'm going to try. Do you remember when you first met?
You came to the pet store looking for a job.
It was summer after sixth grade?
Seventh.
Why do you want to play me?
When they sent me the script, I thought, here is a woman with a lot more to her than I remember from the tabloids.
What would make a 36-year-old woman have an affair with a seventh grader?
People, they like see me as a victim. I wanted it.
This is May December, a drama from Todd Haynes starring Julianne Moore as a woman whose tabloid story romance with an underage boy has prompted a biopic to be made. That film star, played by Natalie Portman, arrives to study her subject and her now grown husband, played by Charles Melton. The film is gaining awards traction, and after a stint in cinemas, it's now available on Sky Cinema. So Emily Murray sat down with Moore, Portman, and Melton to talk about the film. Here's what they had to say.
I'm loving seeing the internet's reaction to this film, and there's quite a debate online right now about if it's camp or not. I'm just wondering, what's your interpretation of that? And yeah, is it camp for you?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. I've heard the term a lot, and I think that it's meant positively, but I do think there's some conflation between camp and melodrama. Because from my understanding, melodrama, I feel like this is a melodrama, and because melodrama is filled. It's filled with emotion. Camp generally stands in for something that's kind of a simulation where there's no real feeling. And I don't think that's not what Todd does. I think what he does so beautifully is he takes these very extreme emotional human situations and relationships and dramatizes them, and that truly is melodrama. But it's funny. I mean, there's some funny things in it because life is funny.
But, like, were you surprised upon getting the script, Ben, about how funny the movie is? Because I think when I went in to see it, I was quite, like, delightfully surprised.
It wasn't funny while we were filming at all. Yeah, it didn't feel funny. It was, you know, so complex and so deep, and just there's so much tragedy in every character. And I think it's interesting to see the audience respond the way they do, where there's so many different emotions, you know. Sometimes it's easier to laugh than to cry in the face of tragedy.
I've never heard of the true story before. I don't know if this was because I'm in the UK, but it's been interesting seeing this video clip go viral this week of Mary Kay interviews, because I don't think I realised how much is drawn from that tale, like direct quotes, like who's the boss, etc. Like, it's so fascinating. Like, did you, especially you, Julianne, like, look at all? Because I know this is a fiction drawn from a true story, but did you look at all at that?
Well, you know, Sammy Birch is very interested in tabloid culture, and that was sort of a jumping off point, you know, for this story. And definitely, I think, used the story as inspiration, but it's also very much her story. So, you know, there was an incredible amount of information out there for us to draw from. And I always look at things whenever I'm working on anything, because I want to ground, I always like to ground my behavior in something real. But the script was the document that we had. Yeah. That the relationship that Gracie and Joe have, you know, Elizabeth Berry, that's what Sammy wrote. And I think that's where we really drew our inspiration.
Yeah, it's an incredible script. And the relationship between Gracie and Elizabeth is fascinating. I love the use of mirrors in the movie and how you guys mirror each other. Can you tell me a bit about, Natalie, like how you sort of started mimicking Julianne's behaviour? Because it's so fascinating to watch on screen, honestly.
It was such an incredible aspect of my character that part of Elizabeth is studying and copying Julianne's character, because in real life, I watch Julianne and want to study her and copy her. I've admired her for so long and been inspired by her for so long. We didn't really have a rehearsal period, so it was lucky that we were shooting relatively chronologically, and it was also lucky that Julianne is very generous in the way she performs, so that while she was creating her character and what was right for her character, she was also thinking about what identifiable traits she could offer me to mimic identifiably. And so her choices were incredible to get to observe, learn, and copy in real time while we were shooting as Elizabeth and Gracie.
And there's like an underlying sense of eroticism as well, I think, at times, which I think I really got after a few watches. But yeah, tell me a bit about leaning into that with your characters, because it's definitely there.
I think it's a struggle for dominance. I mean, I think it's really a power struggle between the two women, like whose story is going to be told, how is the story going to be told. And I think that seduction is another tool for dominance, right? So you realize they're both seducing each other. They're both trying to draw the other one, you know, close to one another in order to gain power.
And also, I think they're so self-regarding. Mm. They're women who, you know, are looking at themselves in the mirror, and when they see themselves reflected, they're attracted to it.
That's right.
You know?
I know what you mean. And even just stuff like sort of things with wigs as well, like how you go from bangs to, it's so smart. I want to talk about Joe, of course. I understand that when you read the script, you really connected with the character. Tell me what sort of drew you into that.
Well, I mean, Sammy's script, it was just so, just a beautiful blueprint to explore Joe. And, you know, I think some things helped inform, find, you know, the character Joe. But personally, you know, sometimes I can find certain parallels where it's, the experience is different, but the feeling is almost similar. And it was the sense of responsibility that Joe had at such a young age. It made me think back to when I was 11 and my dad sat me down and gave me this talk before he went off to war for a year because I was an army brat. And you know, when you're a kid, you're up for the responsibility and you'll put on that shoe that's a little too big and you'll say, yes, I'll do it, Dad. But you know, that was kind of something that Joe stepping into the sense of responsibility that I really related to as far as at such a young age.
So much of his film's about performance. I'm just wondering, as actors, what do you sort of make of what it says about performance? Because obviously, yeah, because you'll have your own take because that's what you do.
I think not just as actors, but as how we're cultured and gender identity too. So I'm struck by, you know, what Charles is just saying about the demands that were, you know, that he felt as a young boy, and that in this story, you know, we amplify mm-hmm. that story where this woman has this so-called like romantic relationship mm-hmm. with someone, and she casts it as this, that he's the prince that rescued her, but mm-hmm. he's only 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So she elevates him to the status of like an adult male, and she remains kind of like childlike and naive and hyper feminine. So, you know, if you're that, you know, in that kind of gender relationship, the man has to be the strong one. So this idea of performative masculinity, performative femininity, you know, all of that is bad for everybody. It's yeah.
I think it really thrives in sort of living in the morally gray. Like my sympathies or my feelings change continually. Did you find that, you know, whilst filming it, whilst reading the script, that like every time a new day on set or something, like your perspective would shift maybe after film?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the amazing things about Sammy's writing is that's one of the questions she poses. Can art be amoral? Can you depict a crime without somehow endorsing it, without somehow, you know, exploiting it? Mm. I think, you know, we all say things often in interviews similar to what Elizabeth says in her class, you know, on
such a good scene, yeah.
Where she's like, oh, the bad characters are the most interesting ones to play, because we're essentially saying it's more interesting what's in the human heart than actually judging, you know, that we're not here to judge. But then at the same time, is like the 1,000th movie about a serial killer, like, what does that do? You know, is it possible to depict something without somehow judging it or without somehow elevating it? It's an important question to ask. I don't think the film answers it or anyone will ever answer it. It's up for debate.
But I don't think anybody in this film, maybe with the exception of Joe, is a reliable narrator. You know, so your sympathies are always shifting based on whose point of view you're in. And I think Todd did that deliberately. You know, he really leaves you off balance. And he does that often in his films, where you go into it thinking, oh, this is the way it's supposed to go. This is how the narration unfolds. Yeah. And suddenly he switches it on you. So he makes you and the audience come to your own decision or understanding.
Okay, so that's it for this week. We have talked about Candy, Snow, and The End of the World. Neil, which one is going to be your film of the week?
I'm going to go with Wonka. I feel that there's a lot of old school, charming entertainment there. And though it doesn't wholly work or it doesn't wholly fit into the Roald Dahl conception of the character, I just think that it's a charming Paul King confection.
I would say Wonka 2, just because I think you can take anybody to see that and nobody's going to have a terrible time. There's going to be something that you enjoy in it. And if nothing more than sitting in the darkness, watching the beautiful spectacle of it. There is scenes in his chocolate shop that are magnificent. So if you are going to see it, do recommend that you take some chocolate with you. Otherwise, you'll have a rumbly tumbly. Right. A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button and you're all set. And a reminder that we have a new issue out today. It's on shelves, ladies and gentlemen. Go and get it. And it is a massive 2024 preview headed up by Matthew Vaughan's Argyle. There's everything there. There's stuff on Dune 2, Masters of the Air, Furiosa, Ghostbusters 2. Everything's in there. Everything you need to know about the coming year. We've also had a good look back at 2023. What is our film of the year? And what are the turkeys? Do get it. It's on shelf now. And if you're doing any journeys for Christmas, it's a very nice companion to have. Go get it. But before we go, we have a listener's question. Danny Dyer and Nick Love have announced a reunion film this week. It's coming. What's your favourite Danny Dyer film? Do you have a favourite Danny Dyer film?
Well, I think it's a toss-up between two, and they're both made around the same time, the mid-2000s, which I think were kind of the peak of Danny Dyer's filmmaking era. The Business, which was another film he made with Nick Love, that was the one where he played a a sort of young Londoner who goes to Malaga and joins these kind of Costa del crime heavies.
It's sort of like Sexy Beast, isn't it? But with Dyer.
Yeah, and it's clad in these kind of incredible sort of fashions and swagger, and the sun's beating down on them. And I think that that's his best collaboration to date with Nick Love. And the other I quite like was made the following year, called Severance, with directed by Christopher Smith. And that's the one where he and a whole bunch of colleagues go off on a sort of bonding weekend in the woods, and they get kind of gradually picked off by the locals in rather gory and disgusting ways. If you're going to choose your best Danny Dyer film, I wouldn't necessarily say there was an abundant number of films to choose from. But those two, I think, would make my choice.
I would go for Human Traffic. That was before he became like Danny Dyer professional cockney, when he was still actually trying to do some character acting. And I think that film is very much of an era, and it has, you know, a great cast that are all still working now. So yeah, Human Traffic is a good one. And although Dyer, you know, he doesn't have a fantastic back catalogue, but you know, people do love him in EastEnders. They do love his sort of personality. He says what he thinks, you know. Who can forget him just totally slagging off the then Prime Minister on a breakfast TV show? He's a sort of cheeky chappy that people like. So I'm going to go for Human Traffic. Let us know on Twitter what you think Dyer's greatest film is. Maybe we do like the top 10 Dyer films in Mag. Who knows? But for now, we're going to say goodbye, and we'll be back next week. So Neil, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Get him up, Pop.
Oompa, loompa, loompa-dee-doo. I've got a perfect puzzle for you. Oompa, loompa, loompa-dee-dee. If you are wise, you'll listen to me.
What do you get when you guzzle down sweets?
Eating as much as an elephant eats.
What are you at getting terribly fat?
What do you think will come of that?
I don't like the look of it.
Oompa loompa doompa dee da. If you're not greedy, you will go far. You will live in happiness too, like the oompa loompa doompa dee do.